This is Elmer Witt on a Friday in September, talking about our Whatchamacallit God, the fifth in a series of five, this one called the God of the Elusive Community. I'm going to be working largely off of this book by Sally McFaig, Models of God, Theology for an Ecological Nuclear Age. As I was saying before the tape started, Sally McFaig is from Vanderbilt Theological Seminary in Nashville, Tennessee. He's written a number of books. The first was Parables of God, and then there was one on metaphorical theology, and then this third one, Models of God. She's explored as a strong feminist, among other things, certainly not exclusively that. Who is it that complains? We have to label theology as liberation theology, feminist theology, black theology, but the rest of the theology doesn't have any adjectives. It should be called white, male, Western theology, but it doesn't have any adjectives. So I don't mean to limit Sally's interest by talking about her being a feminist. But a lot of her response is to the monarchical image of God that is, if not rampant, it's certainly extant and pretty inclusive. And she is has offered some models that I would like to talk about. To get to that point, why would I say an elusive community? Well, years ago, I drew up a file for my filing cabinet that was called Living in Christian Community, ?? I lived here 5 years at Holden, and I still have a file in my filing cabinet that's marked Living in Christian Community, ?? We all seek and desire it. What's the old story about the guy on the island who builds a church because he's isolated all alone, but has to build another church because he has to have a church he doesn't belong to, because it helps define his community. We use all ways, it seems to me, of doing that. The idea of God is communal. The name of God is a communal name, I believe. God is communal. Community, in one sense, is an ideal that we all talk about, but it's also a vivid, if not rigid, reality. We are all communal. The person who says, "I want to be alone," has made a communal statement. If nothing else, cutting out community, but it's based on that. The same with polis, political. People don't want to be political. Well, not to say I don't want to be political is a political statement, obviously. The polis, the people, the gathering of people, is what it's about. That's why one of the people that I think understands politics very well is Ingrid and Jody Kretzmann, who come up here frequently, and because they are very active in the political activities of Chicago, on the outs right now, trying to get back in. But say, this is a political community. Holden is a polis, and then talk about that. The only thing we don't have, the equivalent of a police department. They say maybe we don't have a police department, and we don't have a jail. But even that, maybe people could argue about. Community has to do with sovereignty and suffering. We've been talking about those as aspects of the divine image. Sovereignty, the control, the source, the creation, whatever it may be, and suffering, the identification, or the gathering, or the renewing, or where we use theologically, there's the redeeming of it. We often want to be alone in our sovereignty. I want to be in control of my life. Very important aspect of human existence today. We say it a lot. But we want to be supported in our suffering. Most of us, at least. I think all. My wife always said I enjoyed ill health. I loved to be taken care of. I think that's part of our imaging of God, that independence that we want, and at the same time, not necessarily at all alternatingly, but at the same time, the desire to be supported. What do people look for, or you look for, in community? Want to just pop things up? By this I mean, now I don't mean going somewhere to a special place like Holenberg, but just generally, what do you look for in community? In a family, in a town that you live in, or in a dorm, or a congregation, whatever it may be, what do you look for? Mm-hmm. Or people generally, or what do you look for? Anybody?
Acceptance? Open and direct communication.
Okay. What
give
else?
And take.
Pardon?
Give and take.
Okay.
Love. Responsibility.
Others, what do you look for?
Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Community of interest.
Pardon?
A community of interest.
Of interest.
Some thing in common.
Okay. A common thread. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing when you suddenly in a group for your.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I've been thinking of myself when we were in Africa, and with Peace Corps volunteers, many years younger than we,
mm-hmm.
and in a totally foreign situation,
yes.
And amazing how your such diverse interests and backgrounds and everything, how you formed a real tight community,
mm-hmm.
generally.
Sure.
You didn't agree with everybody, but that there were just you sure. There were very strong bonds that were built.
So it was the fact that you were all there doing that, there was a common thing,
mm-hmm.
pulled you together, yeah. beyond what might have been obstacles elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Where you probably never would have gathered
sure.
with those people
sure.
in other circumstances.
Same thing happens on an airliner,
mm-hmm.
when they say, we're not going to be able to take off because we have trouble with the left front engine or something like that. And all of a sudden everybody gets closer together, starts talking, and uneasy and everything else. It's amazing how danger can create a community as well.
The first year I came to Holden in 77, the theme that year was on Bonhoeffer's life together.
Ah, yes.
The working and praying and
mm-hmm.
Eating together.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Good. Yeah, I listed stuff like physical proximity, project sharing, burden sharing, discussion, as you said, stimulation to be stirred up by it, celebration, things of that kind. What are things that thwart community as far as you concerned? What keeps... Why do I have question marks on my file?
Ego?
Pardon?
Ego?
Common purpose.
Okay. You mean lack of common purpose? What thwarts it? What keeps it from happening?
Competition.
Pardon?
Competition. Misunderstanding.
Uh-huh.
Jealousy.
Pardon?
Jealousy.
Theology?
Jealousy.
Oh, jealousy, excuse me.
No.
Sure.
And lack of a clarity of what of the goals.
Yeah.
I think a lot of times you get involved with something, there's just no direction, and
yeah.
People just don't get to dinner. Mm-hmm.
Could this be selfishness, a lack of caring, just
yeah. Crazy. Yep. Mm-hmm. Selfishness, right. Well, that's why one of the funny things about holiness is saying, you know, that we talk about being in community here. I think it's better to say in community than being in community, but anyway, in community. And then you examine the variety of reasons that people come here. A lot of things, threads that are same, but all kinds of different reasons. This lack of, or this disparate values or disparate goals that are often found within community that even agrees externally. Let's go do it, or let's go be it. There's still, you know, variety within. The need for solitude is often a detriment. If people are together more than they want to be, or well, they feel they would like to be. Timing, that maybe everybody would be in community if they all could be at the same stage, but somebody's here and there, and it gets in the way, it seems to me. Overbearing people who overbear with love or without love, as the case may be. And for some, physical proximity, just having to be close, or fear of intimacy might get in the way as well. I think, you know, obviously there are levels of any kind of community, and I think because it's human beings, there's no community that is just static. But within all of that, it seems to me, it still say there's lots of things that that get in the way. I've known several communities. How about you? Have any of you lived in community other than at Holden? Where? Do you want? Would you willing to say?
I guess a couple. I would have to loosely.
Sure.
The most recent community with Lutheran Volunteers.
Oh yes.
And formerly.
In a house, you guys lived in the same house, ate together at least at times.
Shared meals and responsibilities, financial, social, emotional. With strangers, they didn't know each other. Before that, with a large group of women in college, which was in one organization. And then also sub was just the dormitory life.
Dormitory.
And different families that I've lived with besides my own.
Oh, that's interesting. Somebody else? Anyone else? Another?
Yeah. I've lived with, as I told you, with the Peace Corps volunteers, and also with on mission, a couple of mission stations.
Oh.
Where, you know, you really
Yes.
I've lived on a compound in Somalia with other people pursuing the same project.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I lived on a fishing barge in Alaska.
Ah. Yeah. Wow.
Mostly people worked in
eight and
play together.
Yeah. That's proximity.
Mm-hmm.
I always imagine going through the gangways and bumping against each other for proximity. Good.
It was a large part of
yeah. Okay.
Liberty shared.
Oh, yeah. All right. That's very decent.
Yeah.
I'm sure.
And also the dorm experience and group traveling too.
Yeah, that was another one I was going to mention.
Mm-hmm.
I went to prep school for 6 years. We used to say that we didn't have an adolescence, we went to prep school instead, which meant we had to grow up much later. Or the Bible passage, the imagination of man's heart is evil from his youth. We always said imagination of our hearts was evil from our prep school. Not a healthy situation, but it is. Was an experience in group living. And the crazy part is, has led to some marvelous, marvelous friendships for me. My dearest friend is, we've been friends for 52 years, going back to prep school days. And then, of course, as we implied, family life can be, and I have lived with at times with other families, two of the working relationships I had were community in a very deep sense. The Walter League staff that I had, about nine people that we worked together, didn't live together, but really were an amalgam of people. And with the National Lutheran Campus Ministry staff, there were nine of us there too. There was warmth, and a lot of the things we talked about before, without necessarily living together. And then my traveling with the Center for Global Education, getting into Honduras and El Salvador, we became quickly, especially when we had to ford a raging river, holding onto a rope going across. We became a pretty tight community there for a while. It was Peter Yarrow of Peter, Paul, and Mary was with us. And I have a lovely picture of Peter hanging on for dear life to that rope crossing the river in El Salvador. So there is kind of. My question is, how does our working image of God affect our ability to live in community, or our response even to the idea of community? Is the way we imagine God, whatever it is we've been talking about for a number of days now, the patterns that causes within us, or that we've learned from elsewhere, or that we haven't thought about, or that we even are trying to shed, or that we're trying to deepen? Are most of those patterns, as some would contend, and you certainly have a right to disagree, hierarchical or parental in the sense of power down, rather than parental in another sense could be thought of, or even governmental in the attitude? My feeling is that it does affect that very strongly. And I think that Sally McFaig has some ideas that might help us overcome that or circumvent it at least a little bit. She would say right away, and I certainly would say, not talking about an easy answer by any means at all to imaging God or to living in community. Sally McFaig starts at the premise that the universe is neither indifferent or malevolent, evil by itself, but rather that there is, that the Christian faith, well, let me tell you, she says that the Christian faith is based on the idea that the universe is not indifferent or malevolent, but rather that there is power, indeed a personal power, on the side of life and fulfillment. That there is a personal power on the side of life and fulfillment. It's not different from other ways of saying it, but I think you can see already she's pushing towards some idea of connectedness between the human beings rather than just a one-on-one, God and me kind of stuff. And of course, you'd say that the Christian faith believes that there are some clues for fleshing out this claim that the universe is not indifferent or malevolent in the life, death, and appearances of Jesus Christ, Jesus of Nazareth. She maintains further, as not everybody does, but more people do, that each generation has the responsibility for developing an imaginative picture. That's what we've been talking about all week, that imaging is not once for all, but that it is often responsive. And we don't. It doesn't help us a lot today to think of Mount Olympus as a source for a place for God power to be, or to think of a king particularly. In fact, they're probably maybe some of the worst ones for us, or even a parent, as at least it's been forced on most of us in a sense that makes it authoritative, if not dictatorial, parent. Or even a farmer, for most of us, doesn't have a lot of relevance. So that new metaphors, new models, could be helpful. Especially for, as the subtitle of her book says, for theology in an ecological nuclear age. What's going to work there? To express the saving presence of God in this present world. She talks in general about the world being God's body, rather than the church being the body. She tends to focus on the world being God's body. So how does that saving presence act in relationship to God's body? And what she ends up with, the three models that she works very hard on here, and I'll say a little bit about each of them and end up talking mostly about the third of these. As God as the mother of the world, God as the lover of the world, and God as the friend of the world. The question is, and this is certainly one of my questions, is a personal agent imagery a valid one anymore? Is it a worthwhile one? Is it a workable one? Surprisingly, Sally McFay makes a very strong case that it is. And I'm doing her some injustice at the moment when I say what she says largely about it is that it's the most attractive image that we have because we like people. That's true for everybody here, but by and large it is. And it's the richest because there's so much depth to it. It's organic. Even if we just look at the human body, if we're talking about persons in terms of bodies, the organicness of it is so rich. It's so, say another way, complex. And it's the one image that we know from the inside. Because there could be other images, you know, non-human images, nature, energy. Lots of people talk in terms of energy. Or spirit, in a sense of non-human power, whatever it may be, not conceived in that level, or even places are. But the model that Maffei seems committed to is that the model has to be destabilizing, in other words, not making things all done, and inclusive and non-hierarchical. This is from her reading of the society in which she's in. She says those are the things that are wrecking our society, is the stuff that freezes us in and excludes people and puts power in a certain place only. But that rather what is needed, something that is relational, these are her words, relational, immanental, interdependent, and non-interventionist. Let me say something about each of those. Relational, so that it's connected. Immanental, here with us rather than there. Transcendent up there, immanent here. Interdependent, so that it's working back and forth, as some of the models we've been talking about this week, where God gives power and then has to take the consequences of that. And a non-interventionist, so that God isn't seeing as coming in and fixing up little things all the time. And she would say, even to the point of not dependent only on a theology that says Jesus has to come and fix us. She sees Jesus very real, but more as a metaphor than that reality. In other words, she's trying to say that God is intrinsic to all that exists, intrinsic to all as it gives. And in saying this way, she's trying to make the Christian gospel what she believes it is, a radical and surprising love of the world as God's body. So, the relationship is parent to child, mother, lover to beloved, lover, friend to friend. And this is her trinity, representing the creating, saving, and sustaining activity of God. And that behind each of those, the creative love, she sees agape, that pre-existent, non-dependent kind of love. And the lover, she sees eros, in terms of passion. Passion in wanting and passion in suffering. And then philia, sustaining love, the love of human to human. Clearly making it, saying, because that these are all interrelated and overlapping, and that when you deal with any imagery, there's always a yes and a no. There's a sense in which God would be able to say God is mother, and there's a sense in which God isn't mother. God is lover, God isn't lover. God is friend, God isn't friend. There's more to it. Any metaphor is has those limitations. She sees these as both long existing and not radical in the sense of somebody concocting anything, because the one that we usually work with, that of redemption of a rebellious community, is largely out of St. Paul. And that the other one of a creation of a world loved passionately to the limits of God's very being is largely out of St. John. That both of them would go back to the earliest times rather than saying one's new, one's the other. But that obviously St. Paul, through Augustine and Luther and everybody else, Paul gets the big play. Very difficult for most clergy today, let me say about Lutheran clergy because I know them best, to talk about God without talking about sin and redemption. The scriptures is filled with other modes of talking about that, and yet because of St. Paul, no, because of the emphasis of the history of the church on it, so that our Lutheran categories, for instance, are cast almost exclusively in there, in these categories. One tends to be anthropological through Paul, the people stuff, sinners, get them back, and the other is cosmological, inclusive of the whole of creation, as St. John does. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. A pre-existent Word from way out there has taken place and causes things to happen strangely. Well, a couple things then now about mother, lover, and then a little more about friend, and then seeking your response. One of the advantages of the mother God, and here she would say, not to say there isn't father, but to look at it from this other side, or even a father-mother God, makes you understand that when you're talking about God, you're talking about something that's not like anything else, To talk about mother, of course, that's something you know, but even a father-mother God is even more. Mother is in terms of the source of birth, obviously, but McVeigh would be very upset if you ended up thinking of mother only in terms of the birth process. An equal emphasis on mother desiring reunification with the offspring. Not only to create it, to nourish it, the offspring, but when it gets away, as children tend to do, going on, whatever it may be, always wanting to be reunited with it. And she feels that this is a desirable part of the image. And that the model for that is agape, unearned love. The child doesn't do lots of things for you, and so now I will love it. The child comes out of the womb, love. Again, in normal situations. And that the ethic of the mother as a model for God is justice. To love with heart and mind and soul, neighbor as oneself, offspring as oneself. The second is God is lover. We all agree that God is love. We tend not to want to say love is God. And we are terribly edgy about calling God lover. Obviously, I'm not so sure those are valid ways myself. I think we've been given a bit of a bill of goods. I think that all three of them are aspects of the same love. And to separate them causes us some problems. I don't think that philia has lack of some eros in it. And I think agape, that just loves everybody for no reason at all, has some self-interest in it as well. That makes me feel good to be able to do that, which has more to do with the eros, it seems to me. In contrast to eros, which is a passion, a desire, a need, we tend to want to have God, not to have needs, and not to really be that interested, lest God get too close, and no desire. In other words, a passionless God. And what, of course, Zhang Fei is saying, that thinking of a model of God as lover allows that passion, that wanting, that need, that God needs the relationship to us. Rather than the distant king getting a call in emergency, this is the king calling constantly to stay in touch. Obviously, the possibility of betrayal and estrangement with lover is there. But then the emphasis on lover with commitment and the will to love that continues even when the estrangement takes place. I tell people many times, my wife and I stayed married for 37 and a half years until she took a powder on me through cancer, I jest. But we stayed married because we were stubborn. There were all kinds of reasons not to be married. You know, we had a marvelously imperfect marriage, which is the only kind you can get. But we stayed married because we were stubborn. I'm going to let this thing fall apart for crying out loud, blah, 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 whatever it might be. That's a negative side way of talking about commitment and a will to love. And this is seen then as the saving passion, that the second part of her Trinity is the saving, the salvific dimension in wanting the other and being willing to suffer, the passion of suffering, the passion of Christ in that sense. And the ethic of the lover is healing. A healer, as we heal one another as lovers. And then the last is friend. And I have more to say about this just because I like the model of friend for thinking of God, and because I've done some stuff about it and I'd like to share. Unlike mothers and lovers, some people would say, friends are unnecessary. And in C.S. Lewis has said, yes, friends are unnecessary, like philosophy, like art, and like the universe. We even talk about that, don't we? Well, we're just friends. I love it. But, or the other side, we say, I have many acquaintances, but only a few friends. So either friends are very, very special, or they're almost nothing. And I think that reflects the confusion we have about friendship. Clue. I suspect we are still poor at life in community. I don't know whether it's cause and effect, but I think it may be cause, because we're not very good at friends. and friendship, at being friends. Or that we don't know much about it, or that we don't share much about it, or that we don't understand much about it. And then as soon as I say that, I have to back off because it's understanding the way it works. Because, McFaig points out very clearly, this is a highly complex and mysterious business, the friendship. And if you see the connection to Holy Spirit here as the third person, and she is very uneasy with the whole spirit idea, thinks too nebulous, too colorless. But not with the complexity of what we see or say as teachers, what the Holy Spirit does, or what we are trying to portray when we talk about friends. Mostly we talk about friends as being equal. I'll say it another way after a while. The traditional definition of friends is you have to be equal. And she feels that's, you know, a bad kind of definition, because there are friendships that happen in a variety of ways, and that often even within a friendship, rather than being equal, we are this way and that way. I'm up today, you're down. Somebody we've been friends for years, and one of them gets sick and has to be taken care of. They don't stop being friends because they have to be taken care of, in the sense they're not equal, or they even lose their mental capacities. The friendship isn't the same, but it can remain a friendship as well. The focus of friendship as part of it is the freedom involved, that you are free to become friends. I think that may be true about lovers as well, although but not as much. You're not free to choose a mother. You get the mother, but the freedom emphasizes that there is choice involved, and that you are responsible in the relationship with God. And at the same time, it moves away from the lover. You know, who has it said? Lovers are face to face. Friends are side by side. Now again, I don't think it's always that quite distinct. I don't think that friendship excludes being lovers. In fact, I think one of the best definitions of lovers or of married people is an aspect, includes friendship. And lovers we envision as simply two people, one-on-one. And friends, we talk about having a friend. But friends, it's possible to have more of that. There can be more than one person walking side by side. Or the image that is used by many feminists today of the circle, rather than the marching army or a single file or whatever else the image may be. And although we have talked about children being friends often, because without talking about adults being friends, I think, others feel the same way. Friendship calls for adult characteristics. Trust, commitment, common vision, inclusiveness, celebration of diversity, plus delight and attraction, because there is something that happens in friends. So McFaig ends up saying, friends of the friend of the world, capital F, are invited to join in a vision for the world's well-being. And so this model would have closer tie with solidarity rather than hierarchy, or solidarity rather than an individual. You're bound together with the rest of the friends, going with the friend of God. And that the model is sustaining, as creating with the mother, and healing with the lover, sustaining with the friend, the God who is with us, Emmanuel, the companion on the way, you know, companion with food, cum companis, with food, the person you eat with, and you are nourished with. And so the ethic then becomes companionship. Well, that's a way of thinking about God that McVeigh offers to us. I think it's tough for us to jump into, you know, any, to make great changes. And we maybe make them only in horrendous times. I mean, difficult times. I don't know. I would add to what she says, five aspects. Now, this sounds so right-sided brain of friendship that I think are important for our understanding about it or even talking about it. I think that friendship includes aspects of ingredients of mutuality, trust, openness, risk, and gentleness. I say mutuality rather than equality. By that I mean there's something in the other that you're attracted to. And if it's only that, you know, I have nothing and you have everything, that doesn't bode very well for the future, but there's something in each that is attractive. Might be an ability, might be appearance, might be intellect, might, whatever it may be, but there's some mutuality in it. I think a lot of people have trouble with friendship if they pretend there isn't any mutualness. You've got it all, and I just come here to get from you. Think that way about themselves if they are not confident in themselves, obviously, or if they, you know, somebody has all the money or somebody has all the experience or whatever it is. The friendship can be wobbly. So mutuality is an ingredient. Trust is. And for me, you know, decide to trust, you learn to trust. I can decide to be honest with you, but I'm not going to decide to trust you until I know something more about it. I'm not going to tell you everything about me right off the bat. No way. Until I know. I think I said the other day, when I trusted Ginny, when I say when I trusted Ginny because I can't perfectly trust, that was when in advance of anything that would happen or anything that was said, in advance, whether I liked what she did, said or did, or whether I even understood what she said and did, in advance, I trusted that it was for my well-being and the well-being of our relationship. I just knew that it was. That's not easy. That comes through experience, things together, and it is not constant. But I think it obviously is critical. And related to that is openness, because you can decide to be open, honest with one another. That's difficult for us. And I don't mean that friends automatically share everything, every friend with everything. I don't know of any, my friend Carl for 52 years. I don't think I've made a significant decision without Carl. I don't know of anything I couldn't tell him. At the same time, I don't feel obligated to tell him everything or anything at any given time. But I'm glad to have a place there and some other places where that openness and honesty can be expressed. And obviously, since Ginny died, I miss terribly the openness and honesty I had with her. Friendship is risk as well. The risk of not knowing how much to give of yourself to another. I can give all of Elmer away, so there's no Elmer left to be left in the relationship, which is not very bright. Or I can give so much Elmer that I overwhelm the other person, which is not what it's about. So there's risk. It's a constant risk of it. There's a risk of being rejected, obviously, at any time. It's tough. Many of us resist friendship because of that risk. I think part of that risk is that we don't want people to know us too well. But what I think is more of a risk, unconscious perhaps, is that we don't want to know anybody else too well. Because when somebody else tells us who they are and what they're really about, we've picked up a burden. You've given me yourself, now I got to carry it. Most of us, I think, dodge wanting to carry. In dating, since my wife died and stuff like that, one of the toughest parts is getting acquainted with all the baggage that I carry and the baggage that women friends I've met carry. And I say, I don't want that baggage, you know, and I'm sure people don't want my baggage. But I think that's part. When you get to the point where you do want the baggage and share it, it seems to me the risk is there. And the other risk, it seems to me, in friendship is the risk of owning, of trying to own the other person. Truly, to have a friend is to be willing to let the friend go. And that's tough. If it's the best for the friend to go, are you going to hang on to that person, even if that's only selfish on your own part? Tough risk, I think. And lastly, gentleness. I think that's become more obvious. This is at least a way to say, in all of the mutuality, trust, openness, and risk, gentleness is clear and crucial. And I think we're increasingly being able to say, I used to have to say that I think this is true, now I think most people think it's true, that women are better at expressing gentleness than men are, for whatever reason. I don't think it's necessarily in genes, but it certainly is true in our society, which means that men have much to learn constantly. I have much to learn from women about gentleness. And pray God, women need to teach us, have to be willing to teach us by example or whatever other way. I think God chooses to be mutual with us by giving, not equal, mutual, by giving us authority. God clearly trusts us. We could call that the stupidity of God. Ralph said that this morning. That was a dumb idea, to trust us. That was a dumb idea. But it was God's idea. And to be open with us, again, not that God has to tell us everything, but Jesus says to the disciples, I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends, because I have told you everything I have received from the Father. And God risks with us. God risks the pain, the need to change God's own mind, the need to give up God's own Son, risking on us. And God is gentle. Comes as a child, a baby, rather than overwhelming us with armies, in the arms. Luther says, you know, look at the baby sucking on the nipple. This is your God. You scared? Look at the baby. Gentle. I think those aspects lead us to maybe a more of an openness to that kind of an image of God. Well, that's enough. Got some reactions? We got a couple minutes yet, I guess.
Vesper service last night, mm-hmm. It made me stop and think, you know, who is a friend? Who is an acquaintance? What's the difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I told him afterwards I was really glad because I was working on this.
Tied in with your lectures.
Pardon?
It's kind of tied in with your lectures.
Yes, I said I'm going to be talking about that tomorrow.
What you said, many things that I needed to hear. The image of a mutuality with God or of God meeting me. For heaven's sake, no way. Mm-hmm. I never thought of that before. Mm-hmm. Neutrality never crossed my mind, mm-hmm. or if it did, it was immediately dismissed.
Yeah.
I struggle with the concept of a God meeting me.
Uh-huh, sure.
My God right now is very transcendent.
Yep. It's where most of us come from.
But then, the flip side, I think within there are many images of children and babies and gentleness, and that human need and desire for that. Mm-hmm. But seeing it as kind of something separate from mm-hmm. this God, seeing the God a little bit more magical,
yep.
a different kind of magic than yep. a child. Mm-hmm. But valuable images.
Well, I think that concept of mutuality allows the others the openness, the trust, the gentleness.
I do too.
We have a more of the hierarchical image. It's hard to develop the openness, you know, with an authority.
Indeed.
You can't really have the one without the other.
Mm-hmm.
It's really critical that mutuality. But I know what you mean, and I know that you feel. Who are you to think that, you know, God has a need for you? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know you have a need for Him, but that there's a need on the other part. But there is when you really are honest about it.
That's where the application of the analogy of friendship.
Yeah, it works. It really
kind of puts
works
the pattern over the other and makes it fit better.
Mm-hmm. And I agreed earlier with you, which was from Hurton, the author's statement,
yeah.
that it really does work. It makes it more understandable to think of the humanness in the image, simply because that's the perspective that you're from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what you can understand and relate to.
Mm-hmm.
And I always have a problem with that, feeling guilty of presuming on the type of an imagery.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's the best perspective we have to look at.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that the faith, you know, deals realistically and honestly with the age in which we are. She's of the age, mm-hmm. and she's what represents what I think is an American theology. Mm-hmm. And I think that seminary training ought to be American in that sense, not rah-rah flag, but that it is contemporary. And mm-hmm. I think that she's dealing with that. And it's maybe more first world than mm-hmm. it is others. But again, that's where we are as well, too.
Yeah.
There may be, well, that there's a better and different way of expressing it for the third world.